Chapter 21 The House Elf Liberation Front. Harry, Ron and Hermione went up to the owlery that evening to find Pigwidgeon, so that Harry could send Sirius a letter, telling him that he had managed to get past his dragon unscathed. On the way, Harry filled Ron in on everything Sirius had told him about Karkaroff. Though shocked at first to hear that Karkaroff had been a Death Eater, by the time they entered the owlery, Ron was saying that they ought to have suspected it all along. "Fits, doesn't it?" he said. "Remember what Malfoy said on the train about his dad being friends with Karkaroff? Now we know where they knew each other. They were probably running around in masks together at the World Cup. I'll tell you one thing, though, Harry. If it was Karkaroff who put your name in the goblet, he's going to be feeling really stupid now, isn't he? Didn't work, did it? You only got a scratch. Come here, I'll do it." Pigwidgeon was so overexcited at the idea of a delivery, he was flying round and round Harry's head, hooting incessantly. Ron snatched Pigwidgeon out of the air and held him still while Harry attached the letter to his leg. "There's no way any of the other tasks are going to be that dangerous. How could they be?" Ron went on as he carried Pigwidgeon to the window. "You know what? I reckon you could win this tournament, Harry. I'm serious." Harry knew that Ron was only saying this to make up for his behaviour of the last few weeks, but he appreciated it all the same. Hermione, however, leant against the owlery wall, folded her arms and frowned at Ron. "Harry's got a long way to go before he finishes this tournament," she said seriously. "If that was the first task, I hate to think what's coming next." "Right, little ray of sunshine, aren't you?" said Ron. "You and Professor Trelawney should get together sometime." He threw Pigwidgeon out of the window. Pigwidgeon plummeted 12 feet before managing to pull himself back up again. The letter attached to his leg was much longer and heavier than usual. Harry hadn't been able to resist giving Sirius a blow-by-blow account of exactly how he had swerved, circled, and dodged the horntail. They watched Pigwidgeon disappear into the darkness, and then Ron said, "Well, we'd better get downstairs for your surprise party, Harry. Fred and George should have nicked enough food from the kitchens by now." Sure enough, when they entered the Gryffindor common room, it exploded with cheers and yells again. There were mountains of cakes and flagons of pumpkin juice and butterbeer on every surface. Lee Jordan had let off some Dr. Filibuster's fabulous no-heat, wet-start fireworks, so that the air was thick with stars and sparks, and Dean Thomas, who was very good at drawing, had put up some impressive new banners, most of which depicted Harry zooming around the horntail's head on his firebolt, though a couple showed Cedric with his head on fire. Harry helped himself to food. He had almost forgotten what it was like to feel properly hungry, and sat down with Ron and Hermione. He couldn't believe how happy he felt. He had Ron back on his side. He'd got through the first task, and he wouldn't have to face the second one for 3 months. "Blimey, this is heavy," said Lee Jordan, picking up the golden egg, which Harry had left on a table, and weighing it in his hands. "Open it, Harry, go on. Let's just see what's inside it." "He's supposed to work out the clue on his own," Hermione said swiftly. "It's in the tournament rules."
"I was supposed to work out how to get past the dragon on my own, too," Harry muttered, so only Hermione could hear him, and she grinned rather guiltily.
"Yeah, go on, Harry, open it," several people echoed. Lee passed Harry the egg, and Harry dug his fingernails into the groove that ran all the way around it and prized it open. It was hollow and completely empty. But the moment Harry opened it, the most horrible noise, a loud and screechy wailing, filled the room. The nearest thing to it Harry had ever heard was the ghost orchestra at Nearly Headless Nick's Death Day party, who had all been playing the musical Saw.
"Shut it!" Fred bellowed, his hands over his ears.
"What was that?" said Seamus Finnegan, staring at the egg as Harry slammed it shut again.
"Sounded like a banshee! Maybe you've got to get past one of those next, Harry."
"It was someone being tortured,"
said Neville, who had gone very white and spilled sausage rolls over the floor.
"You're going to have to fight the Cruciatus curse."
"Don't be a prat, Neville, that's illegal," said George. "They wouldn't use the Cruciatus curse on the champions. I thought it sounded a bit like Percy singing. Maybe you've got to attack him while he's in the shower, Harry."
"Want a jam tart, Hermione?" said Fred.
Hermione looked doubtfully at the plate he was offering her. Fred grinned.
"It's all right," he said. "I haven't done anything to them. It's the custard creams you've got to watch. Neville, who had just bitten into a custard cream, choked and spat it out. Fred laughed. Just my little joke, Neville. Hermione took a jam tart. Then she said, "Did you get all this from the kitchens, Fred?"
"Yep," said Fred, grinning at her.
He put on a high-pitched squeak and imitated a house elf.
"Anything we can get you, sir. Anything at all."
"They're dead helpful. Get me a roast ox if I said I was peckish." "How do you get in there?" Hermione said in an innocently casual sort of voice.
"Easy," said Fred. "Concealed door behind a painting of a bowl of fruit. Just tickle the pear, and it giggles and—"
He stopped and looked suspiciously at her. "Why?"
"Nothing," said Hermione quickly.
"Going to try and lead the house elves out on strike now, are you?" said George. "Going to give up all the leaflet stuff and try and stir them up into rebellion?"
Several people chortled. Hermione didn't answer.
"Don't you go upsetting them and telling them they've got to take clothes and salaries," said Fred warningly. "You'll put them off their cooking."
Just then, Neville caused a slight diversion by turning into a large canary.
"Oh, sorry, Neville," Fred shouted over all the laughter. "I forgot it was the custard creams we hexed."
Within a minute, however, Neville had molted, and once his feathers had fallen off, he reappeared looking entirely normal. He even joined in laughing.
"Canary creams!" Fred shouted to the excitable crowd. "George and I invented them. 7 sickles each. Bargain!"
It was nearly 1 in the morning when Harry finally went up to the dormitory with Ron, Neville, Seamus and Dean. Before he pulled the curtains of his 4-poster shut, Harry set his tiny model of the Hungarian horntail on the table next to his bed, where it yawned, curled up and closed its eyes. Really, Harry thought, as he pulled the hangings on his 4-poster closed, Hagrid had a point. They were all right, really, dragons. The start of December brought wind and sleet to Hogwarts. Drafty though the castle always was in winter, Harry was glad of its fires and thick walls every time he passed the Durmstrang ship on the lake, which was pitching in the high winds, its black sails billowing against the dark skies. He thought the Beauxbatons caravan was likely to be pretty chilly too. Hagrid, he noticed, was keeping Madame Maxime's horses well provided with their preferred drink of single malt whisky. The fumes wafting from the trough in the corner of their paddock were enough to make the entire Care of Magical Creatures class light-headed. This was unhelpful, as they were still tending the horrible scroots and needed their wits about them.
"I'm not sure whether they hibernate or not,"
Hagrid told the shivering class in the windy pumpkin patch next lesson.
"Thought we'd just try and see if they fancied a kip. We'll just settle them down in these boxes."
There were now only 10 scroots left. Apparently their desire to kill each other had not been exercised out of them. Each of them was now approaching 6 feet in length. Their thick grey armour, their powerful scuttling legs, their fire-blasting ends, their stings and their suckers combined to make the scroots the most repulsive things Harry had ever seen. The class looked dispiritedly at the enormous boxes Hagrid had brought out, all lined with pillows and fluffy blankets.
"We'll just lead him in here," Hagrid said, "and put the lids on, and we'll see what happens."
But the scroots, it transpired, did not hibernate, and did not appreciate being forced into pillow-lined boxes and nailed in. Hagrid was soon yelling,
"Don't panic now, don't panic!"
while the scroots rampaged around the pumpkin patch, now strewn with the smouldering wreckage of the boxes. Most of the class, Malfoy, Crabbe and Goyle in the lead, had fled into Hagrid's cabin through the back door and barricaded themselves in. Harry, Ron and Hermione, however, were among those who remained outside, trying to help Hagrid. Together they managed to restrain and tie up 9 of the scroots, though at the cost of numerous burns and cuts. Finally, only 1 scroot was left.
"Don't frighten him now,"
Hagrid shouted, as Ron and Harry used their wands to shoot jets of fiery sparks at the scroot, which was advancing menacingly on them, its sting arched, quivering over its back.
"Just try and slip the rope round his sting so he won't hurt any of the others." "Yeah, we wouldn't want that,"
Ron shouted angrily, as he and Harry backed into the wall of Hagrid's cabin, still holding the scroot off with their sparks.
"Well, well, well, this
does look like fun."
Rita Skeeter was leaning on Hagrid's garden fence, looking in at the mayhem. She was wearing a thick magenta cloak with a furry purple collar today, and her crocodile-skin handbag was over her arm. Hagrid launched himself forward on top of the scroot that was cornering Harry and Ron and flattened it. A blast of fire shot out of its end, withering the pumpkin plants nearby.
"Who are you?"
Hagrid asked Rita Skeeter as he slipped a loop of rope around the scroot's sting and tightened it.
"Rita Skeeter, Daily Prophet reporter," Rita replied, beaming at him. Her gold teeth glinted.
"Thought Dumbledore said you weren't allowed inside the school any more,"
said Hagrid, frowning slightly as he got off the slightly squashed scroot and started tugging it over to its fellows. Rita acted as though she hadn't heard what Hagrid had said.
"What are these fascinating creatures called?" she asked, beaming still more widely.
"Blast-ended scroots," grunted Hagrid.
"Really?" said Rita, apparently full of lively interest. "I've never heard of them before. Where do they come from?"
Harry noticed a dull red flush rising up out of Hagrid's wild black beard, and his heart sank. Where had Hagrid got the scroots from? Hermione, who seemed to be thinking along the same lines, said quickly,
"They're very interesting, aren't they? Aren't they, Harry?"
"What?
Oh, yeah, ouch! Interesting," said Harry, as she stepped on his foot. "Ah, you're here, Harry," said Rita Skeeter, as she looked around. "So you like care of magical creatures, do you? One of your favourite lessons?"
"Yes," said Harry stoutly. Hagrid beamed at him.
"Lovely," said Rita. "Really lovely. Been teaching long?" she added to Hagrid.
Harry noticed her eyes travel over Dean, who had a nasty cut across one cheek, Lavender, whose robes were badly singed, Seamus, who was nursing several burnt fingers, and then to the cabin windows, where most of the class stood, their noses pressed against the glass, waiting to see if the coast was clear.
"This is only my second year," said Hagrid.
"Lovely. I don't suppose you'd like to give an interview, would you? Share some of your experience of magical creatures? The Prophet does a zoological column every Wednesday, as I'm sure you know. We could feature these, bang-ended scroots."
"Blast-ended scroots," Hagrid said eagerly.
Yeah, why not?"
Harry had a very bad feeling about this, but there was no way of communicating it to Hagrid without Rita Skeeter seeing, so he had to stand and watch in silence as Hagrid and Rita Skeeter made arrangements to meet in the Three Broomsticks for a good long interview later that week. Then the bell rang up at the castle, signalling the end of the lesson.
"Well, goodbye, Harry,"
Rita Skeeter called merrily to him as he set off with Ron and Hermione.
"Until Friday night, then, Hagrid."
"She'll twist everything he says," Harry said under his breath.
"Just as long as he didn't import those scroots illegally or anything," said Hermione desperately. They looked at each other. It was exactly the sort of thing Hagrid might do.
"Hagrid's been in loads of trouble before, and Dumbledore's never sacked him," said Ron consolingly. "Worst that can happen is Hagrid'll have to get rid of the scroots. Sorry, did I say worst?
I meant best." Harry and Hermione laughed, and feeling slightly more cheerful, went off to lunch. Harry thoroughly enjoyed double divination that afternoon. They were still doing star charts and predictions, but now that he and Ron were friends once more, the whole thing seemed very funny again. Professor Trelawney, who had been so pleased with the pair of them when they had been predicting their own horrific deaths, quickly became irritated as they sniggered through her explanation of the various ways in which Pluto could disrupt everyday life.
"I would think," she said, in a mystical whisper that did not conceal her obvious annoyance, "that some of us," she stared very meaningfully at Harry, "might be a little less frivolous had they seen what I have seen during my crystal-gazing last night. As I sat here, absorbed in my needlework, the urge to consult the orb overpowered me. I arose, I settled myself before it, and I gazed into its crystalline depths. And what do you think I saw gazing back at me?"
"An ugly old bat in outsized specs," Ron muttered under his breath.
Harry fought hard to keep his face straight.
Death, my dears.
Parvati and Lavender both put their hands over their mouths, looking horrified.
Yes, said Professor Trelawney, nodding impressively. It comes ever closer. It circles overhead like a vulture. Ever lower over the castle.
She stared pointedly at Harry, who yawned very widely and obviously.
It'd be a bit more impressive if she hadn't done it about 80 times before, Harry said, as they finally regained the fresh air of the staircase beneath Professor Trelawney's room. But if I'd dropped dead every time she's told me I'm going to, I'd be a medical miracle.
You'd be a sort of extra-concentrated ghost, said Ron, chortling,
as they passed the bloody Baron, going in the opposite direction, his wide eyes staring sinisterly.
At least we didn't get homework. I hope Hermione got loads off Professor Vector. I love not working when she is.
But Hermione wasn't at dinner. And nor was she in the library when they went to look for her afterwards. The only person in there was Victor Crumb. Ron hovered behind the bookshelves for a while, watching Crumb, debating in whispers with Harry whether he should ask for an autograph. But then Ron realised that 6 or 7 girls were lurking in the next row of books, debating exactly the same thing, and he lost his enthusiasm for the idea.
"Wonder where she's got to,"
Ron said, as he and Harry went back to Gryffindor Tower.
"Dunno. Balderdash."
But the fat lady had barely begun to swing forwards when the sound of racing feet behind them announced Hermione's arrival.
"Harry!" she panted, skidding to a halt beside him.
The fat lady stared down at her, eyebrows raised.
"Harry, you've got to come! You've got to come! The most amazing thing's happened! Please!"
She seized Harry's arm and started to try and drag him back along the corridor.
"What's the matter?" Harry said.
"I'll show you when we get there. Oh, come on, quick!"
Harry looked around at Ron. He looked back at Harry, intrigued.
"Okay,"
Harry said, starting off back down the corridor with Hermione, Ron hurrying to keep up.
"Oh, don't mind me," the fat lady called irritably after them. "Don't apologise for bothering me. I'll just hang here wide open until you get back, shall I?"
"Yeah, thanks," Ron shouted over his shoulder.
"Hermione, where are we going?"
Harry asked after she had led them down through 6 floors and started down the marble staircase into the entrance hall.
You'll see in a minute," said Hermione excitedly.
She turned left at the bottom of the staircase and hurried towards the door through which Cedric Diggory had gone the night after the Goblet of Fire had regurgitated his and Harry's names. Harry had never been through here before. He and Ron followed Hermione down a flight of stone steps, but instead of ending up in a gloomy underground passage like the one which led to Snape's dungeon, they found themselves in a broad stone corridor, brightly lit with torches and decorated with cheerful paintings that were mainly of food.
"Oh, hang on," said Harry slowly, halfway down the corridor. "Wait a minute, Hermione."
"What?"
She turned around to look at him, anticipation all over her face.
"I know what this is about," said Harry.
He nudged Ron and pointed to the painting just behind Hermione. It showed a gigantic silver fruit bowl.
"Hermione," said Ron, cottoning on, "you're trying to rope us into that spew stuff again."
"No, no, I'm not," she said hastily. "And it's not spew, Ron."
"Changed the name, have you?" said Ron, frowning at her. "What are we now, then? The House Elf Liberation Front? I'm not barging into that kitchen and trying to make them stop work. I'm not doing it."
"I'm not asking you to," Hermione said impatiently. "I came down here just now to talk to them all, and I found... Oh, come on, Harry, I want to show you."
She seized his arm again, pulled him in front of the picture of the giant fruit bowl, stretched out her forefinger, and tickled the huge green pear. It began to squirm, chuckling, and suddenly turned into a large green door handle. Hermione seized it, pulled the door open, and pushed Harry hard in the back, forcing him inside. He had one brief glimpse of an enormous, high-ceilinged room, large as the great hall above it, with mounds of glittering brass pots and pans heaped around the stone walls, and a great brick fireplace at the other end, when something small hurtled towards him from the middle of the room, squealing,
"Harry Potter, sir! Harry Potter!"
Next second, all the wind had been knocked out of him as the squealing elf hit him hard in the midriff, hugging him so tightly he thought his ribs would break.
"Dobby!" Harry gasped. "It is Dobby, sir, it is!"
squealed the voice from somewhere around his navel.
"Dobby has been hoping and hoping to see Harry Potter, sir, and Harry Potter has come to see him, sir!"
Dobby let go and stepped back a few paces, beaming up at Harry, his enormous green tennis-ball-shaped eyes brimming with tears of happiness. He looked almost exactly as Harry remembered him, the pencil-shaped nose, the bat-like ears, the long fingers and feet, all except the clothes, which were now very different. When Dobby had worked for the Malfoys, he had always worn the same filthy old pillowcase. Now, however, he was wearing the strangest assortment of garments Harry had ever seen. He had made an even worse job of dressing himself than the wizards at the World Cup. He was wearing a tea-cosy for a hat, on which he had pinned a number of bright badges, a tie patterned with horseshoes over a bare chest, a pair of what looked like children's football shorts, and odd socks. One of these, Harry saw, was the black one he had removed from his own foot and tricked Mr. Malfoy into giving Dobby, thereby setting Dobby free. The other was covered in pink and orange stripes.
"Dobby, what are you doing here?" Harry said in amazement.
"Dobby has come to work at Hogwarts, sir," Dobby squealed excitedly. "Professor Dumbledore gave Dobby and Winky jobs, sir."
"Winky," said Harry, "she's here too."
"Yes, sir, yes,"
said Dobby, and he seized Harry's hand and pulled him off into the kitchen between the four long wooden tables that stood there. Each of these tables, Harry noticed as he passed them, was positioned exactly beneath the four house tables above in the great hall. At the moment they were clear of food, dinner having finished, but he supposed that an hour ago they had been laden with dishes that were then sent up through the ceiling to their counterparts above. At least 100 little elves were standing around the kitchen, beaming, bowing and curtsying as Dobby led Harry past them. They were all wearing the same uniform, a tea towel stamped with the Hogwarts crest and tied, as Winky's had been, like a toga. Dobby stopped in front of the brick fireplace and pointed.
"Winky, sir," he said.
Winky was sitting on a stool by the fire. Unlike Dobby, she had obviously not foraged for clothes. She was wearing a neat little skirt and blouse with a matching blue hat, which had holes in it for her large ears. However, while every one of Dobby's strange collection of garments was so clean and well cared for that it looked brand new, Winky was plainly not taking care of her clothes at all. There were soup stains all down her blouse and a burn in her skirt.
"Hello, Winky," said Harry.
Winky's lip quivered. Then she burst into tears, which spilled out of her great brown eyes and splashed down her front, just as they had done at the Quidditch World Cup.
"Oh, dear," said Hermione.
She and Ron had followed Harry and Dobby to the end of the kitchen.
"Winky, don't cry. Please don't."
But Winky cried harder than ever. Dobby, on the other hand, beamed up at Harry.
"Would Harry Potter like a cup of tea?"
he squeaked loudly over Winky's sobs.
"Yeah, okay," said Harry.
Instantly, about 6 house elves came trotting up behind him, bearing a large silver tray laden with teapots, cups for Harry, Ron and Hermione, a milk jug and a large plate of biscuits.
"Good service," Ron said in an impressed voice.
Hermione frowned at him, but the elves all looked delighted. They bowed very low and retreated.
"How long have you been here, Dobby?" Harry asked as Dobby handed round the tea.
"Only a week, Harry Potter, sir," said Dobby happily. "Dobby came to see Professor Dumbledore, sir. You see, sir, it is very difficult for a house elf who has been dismissed to get a new position, sir. Very difficult indeed."
At this, Winky howled even harder, her squashed tomato of a nose dribbling all down her front, though she made no effort to stem the flow.
"Dobby has travelled the country for 2 whole years, sir, trying to find work," Dobby squeaked. "But Dobby hasn't found work, sir, because Dobby wants paying now."
The house elves all around the kitchen, who had been listening and watching with interest, all looked away at these words, as though Dobby had said something rude and embarrassing. Hermione, however, said,
Good for you, Dobby.
Thank you, miss,
said Dobby, grinning toothily at her.
But most wizards don't want a house elf who wants paying, miss. That's not the point of a house elf, they says, and they slammed the door in Dobby's face. Dobby likes work, but he wants to wear clothes, and he wants to be paid, Harry Potter. Dobby likes being free.
The Hogwarts house elves had now started edging away from Dobby, as though he was carrying something contagious. Winky, however, remained where she was, though there was a definite increase in the volume of her crying.
And then, Harry Potter, Dobby goes to visit Winky and finds out Winky has been freed too, sir, said Dobby delightedly.
At this, Winky flung herself forwards off her stool and lay face down on the flagged stone floor, beating her tiny fists upon it and positively screaming with misery. Hermione hastily dropped down to her knees beside her and tried to comfort her, but nothing she said made the slightest difference. Dobby continued with his story, shouting shrilly over Winky's screeches.
And then Dobby had the idea, Harry Potter, sir. Why doesn't Dobby and Winky find work together, Dobby says. Where is there enough work for two house elves, says Winky. And Dobby thinks, and it comes to him, sir. Hogwarts! So Dobby and Winky come to see Professor Dumbledore, sir. And Professor Dumbledore took us on!
Dobby beamed very brightly, and happy tears welled in his eyes again.
And Professor Dumbledore says he will pay Dobby, sir, if Dobby wants paying. And so Dobby is a free elf, sir, and Dobby gets a galleon a week and one day off a month.
That's not very much, Hermione shouted indignantly from the floor over Winky's continued screaming and fist-beating.
Professor Dumbledore offered Dobby 10 galleons a week and weekends off, said Dobby,
suddenly giving a little shiver, as though the prospect of so much leisure and riches was frightening.
But Dobby beat him down, miss. Dobby likes freedom, miss, but he isn't wanting too much, miss. He likes work better.
And how much is Professor Dumbledore paying you, Winky?
Hermione asked kindly. If she had thought this would cheer Winky up, she was wildly mistaken. Winky did stop crying, but when she sat up, she was glaring at Hermione through her massive brown eyes, her whole face sopping wet and suddenly furious.
Winky is a disgraced elf, but Winky is not yet getting paid, she squeaked. Winky is not sunk so low as that. Winky is properly ashamed of being freed.
Ashamed? Said Hermione, blankly.
But, Winky, come on. It's Mr. Crouch who should be ashamed, not you. You didn't do anything wrong. He was really horrible to you.
But at these words, Winky clapped her hands over the holes in her hat, flattening her ears so that she couldn't hear a word, and screeched,
You is not insulting my master, miss! You is not insulting Mr. Crouch! Mr. Crouch is a good wizard, miss! Mr. Crouch is right to sack bad Winky! Winky is having trouble adjusting, Harry Potter,
squeaked Dobby confidentially.
Winky forgets she is not bound to Mr. Crouch any more. She is allowed to speak her mind now, but she won't do it.
Can't house elves speak their minds about their masters, then? Harry asked.
Oh, no, sir, no, said Dobby, looking suddenly serious. 'Tis part of the house elves' enslavement, sir. We keeps their secrets and are silent, sir. We upholds the family's honour, and we never speaks ill of them. Though Professor Dumbledore told Dobby he does not insist upon this. Professor Dumbledore said we is free to...
Dobby looked suddenly nervous and beckoned Harry closer. Harry bent forwards. Dobby whispered,
He said we is free to call him a balmy old codger, if we likes, sir.
Dobby gave a frightened sort of giggle.
But Dobby is not wanting to, Harry Potter,
he said, talking normally again, and shaking his head so that his ears flapped.
Dobby likes Professor Dumbledore very much, sir, and is proud to keep his secrets for him.
But you can say what you like about the Malfoys now, Harry asked him, grinning. A slightly fearful look came into Dobby's immense eyes.
Dobby could, he said, doubtfully.
He squared his small shoulders.
Dobby could tell Harry Potter that his old masters were bad, dark wizards.
Dobby stood for a moment, quivering all over, horror-struck by his own daring. Then he rushed over to the nearest table and began banging his head on it, very hard, squealing,
"Bad Dobby! Bad Dobby!"
Harry seized Dobby by the back of his tie and pulled him away from the table.
"Thank you, Harry Potter, thank you,"
said Dobby breathlessly, rubbing his head. "You just need a bit of practice," Harry said.
"Practice?" squealed Winky furiously. "You is ought to be ashamed of yourself, Dobby, talking that way about your masters." "They isn't my masters any more, Winky,"
said Dobby defiantly.
"Dobby doesn't care what they think any more." "Oh, you is a bad elf, Dobby,"
moaned Winky, tears leaking down her face once more.
"My poor Mr. Crouch, what is he doing without Winky? He is needing me. He is needing my help. I is looking after the Crouches all my life, and my mother is doing it before me, and my grandmother is doing it before her. Oh, what is they saying if they knew Winky was freed? Oh, the shame! The shame!"
She buried her face in her skirt again and bawled.
"Winky," said Hermione firmly, "I'm quite sure Mr. Crouch is getting along perfectly well without you. We've seen him, you know."
"You is seeing my master?"
said Winky breathlessly, raising her tear-stained face out of her skirt once more and goggling at Hermione.
"You is seeing him here at Hogwarts?"
"Yes," said Hermione. "He and Mr. Bagman are judges in the Tri-Wizard Tournament."
"Mr. Bagman comes too,"
squeaked Winky, and to Harry's great surprise, and Ron and Hermione's too, by the looks on their faces, she looked angry again.
"Mr. Bagman is a bad wizard, a very bad wizard. My master isn't liking him. Oh, no, not at all."
"Bagman? Bad?" said Harry.
"Oh, yes,"
Winky said, nodding her head furiously.
"My master is telling Winky some things, but Winky is not saying. Winky keeps her master's secrets."
She dissolved yet again in tears. They could hear her sobbing into her skirt.
"Poor master! Poor master! No Winky to help him no more."
They couldn't get another sensible word out of Winky. They left her to her crying and finished their tea, while Dobby chatted happily about his life as a free elf and his plans for his wages.
"Dobby is going to buy a jumper next, Harry Potter,"
he said happily, pointing at his bare chest. "Tell me what, Dobby," said Ron, who seemed to have taken a great liking to the elf. "I'll give you the one my mum knits me this Christmas. I always get one from her. You don't mind maroon, do you?" Dobby was delighted. "We might have to shrink it a bit to fit you," Ron told him, "but it'll go well with your tea cosy." As they prepared to take their leave, many of the surrounding elves pressed in upon them, offering snacks to take back upstairs. Hermione refused, with a pained look at the way the elves kept bowing and curtsying, but Harry and Ron loaded their pockets with cream cakes and pies. "Thanks a lot," Harry said to the elves, who had all clustered around the door to say good night. "See you, Dobby."
"Harry Potter, can Dobby come and see you sometimes, sir?"
Dobby asked tentatively.
"Course you can," said Harry, and Dobby beamed.
"You know what," said Ron, once he, Hermione and Harry had left the kitchens behind and were climbing the steps into the entrance hall again. "All these years I've been really impressed with Fred and George nicking food from the kitchens. Well, it's not exactly difficult, is it? They can't wait to give it away."
"I think this is the best thing that could have happened to those elves, you know," said Hermione, leading the way back up the marble staircase. "Dobby coming to work here, I mean. The other elves will see how happy he is being free, and slowly it'll dawn on them that they want that too."
"Let's hope they don't look too closely at Winky," said Harry.
"Oh, she'll cheer up," said Hermione, though she sounded a bit doubtful. "Once the shock's worn off and she's got used to Hogwarts, she'll see how much better off she is without that Crouch man."
"She seems to love him," said Ron thickly. He had just started on a cream cake.
"Doesn't think much of Bagman, though, does she?" said Harry. "Wonder what Crouch says at home about him."
"Probably says he's not a very good head of department," said Hermione. "And let's face it, he's got a point, hasn't he?"
"I'd still rather work for him than old Crouch," said Ron. "At least Bagman's got a sense of humour."
"Don't let Percy hear you saying that," Hermione said, smiling slightly.
"Yeah, well, Percy wouldn't want to work for anyone with a sense of humour, would he?" said Ron, now starting on a chocolate éclair. "Percy wouldn't recognise a joke if it danced naked in front of him wearing Dobby's tea cosy."
Chapter 22. The Unexpected Task.
"Potter! Weasley! Will you pay attention?"
Professor McGonagall's irritated voice cracked like a whip through the Transfiguration class on Thursday, and Harry and Ron both jumped and looked up. It was the end of the lesson. They had finished their work. The guinea fowl they had been changing into guinea pigs had been shut away in a large cage on Professor McGonagall's desk. Neville's guinea pig still had feathers. They had copied down their homework from the blackboard. "Describe, with examples, the ways in which transforming spells must be adapted when performing cross-species switches." The bell was due to ring at any moment, and Harry and Ron, who had been having a sword fight with a couple of Fred and George's fake wands at the back of the class, looked up, Ron now holding a tin parrot, and Harry a rubber haddock.
"Now Potter and Weasley have been kind enough to act their age," said Professor McGonagall, with an angry look at the pair of them as the head of Harry's haddock drooped and fell silently to the floor. Ron's parrot's beak had severed it moments before. "I have something to say to you all. The Yule Ball is approaching, a traditional part of the Triwizard Tournament, and an opportunity for us to socialise with our foreign guests. Now, the ball will be open only to fourth years and above, although you may invite a younger student if you wish." Lavender Brown let out a shrill giggle. Parvati Patil nudged her hard in the ribs, her face working furiously as she, too, fought not to giggle. They both looked around at Harry. Professor McGonagall ignored them, which Harry thought was distinctly unfair, as she had just told off him and Ron.
"Dress robes will be worn," Professor McGonagall continued, "and the ball will start at 8 o'clock on Christmas Day, finishing at midnight in the Great Hall. Now then,"
Professor McGonagall stared deliberately around the class,
"the Yule Ball is, of course, a chance for us all to, let our hair down," she said in a disapproving voice.
Lavender giggled harder than ever, with her hand pressed hard against her mouth to stifle the sound. Harry could see what was funny this time. Professor McGonagall, with her hair in a tight bun, looked as though she had never let her hair down in any sense.
"But that does not mean," Professor McGonagall went on, "that we will be relaxing the standards of behaviour we expect from Hogwarts students. I will be most seriously displeased if a Gryffindor student embarrasses the school in any way."
The bell rang, and there was the usual scuffle of activity as everyone packed their bags and swung them onto their shoulders. Professor McGonagall called above the noise,
"Potter, a word, if you please."
Assuming this had something to do with his headless rubber haddock, Harry proceeded gloomily to the teacher's desk. Professor McGonagall waited until the rest of the class had gone, and then said,
"Potter, the champions and their partners..."
"What partners?" said Harry. Professor McGonagall looked suspiciously at him, as though she thought he was trying to be funny.
"Your partners for the Yule Ball, Potter," she said coldly. "Your dance partners."
Harry's insides seemed to curl up and shrivel.
"Dance partners?"
He felt himself going red.
"I don't dance," he said quickly.
"Oh, yes, you do," said Professor McGonagall irritably. "That's what I'm telling you. Traditionally, the champions and their partners open the ball."
Harry had a sudden mental image of himself in a top hat and tails, accompanied by a girl in the sort of frilly dress Aunt Petunia always wore to Uncle Vernon's work parties.
"I'm not dancing," he said.
"It is traditional," said Professor McGonagall firmly. "You are a Hogwarts champion, and you will do what is expected of you as a representative of the school. So, make sure you get yourself a partner, Potter."
"But I don't..."
"You heard me, Potter," said Professor McGonagall,
in a very final sort of way. A week ago, Harry would have said finding a partner for a dance would be a cinch compared to taking on a Hungarian horntail.
But now that he had done the latter, and was facing the prospect of asking a girl to the ball, he thought he'd rather have another round with the horntail. Harry had never known so many people to put their names down to stay at Hogwarts for Christmas. He always did, of course, because the alternative was usually going back to Privet Drive, but he had always been very much in the minority before now. This year, however, everyone in the fourth year and above seemed to be staying, and they all seemed to Harry to be obsessed with the coming ball, or at least all the girls were, and it was amazing how many girls Hogwarts suddenly seemed to hold. He had never quite noticed that before. Girls giggling and whispering in the corridors, girls shrieking with laughter as boys passed them, girls excitedly comparing notes on what they were going to wear on Christmas night. "Why do they have to move in packs?" Harry asked Ron, as a dozen or so girls walked past them, sniggering and staring at Harry. "How are you supposed to get one on their own to ask them?" "Lasso one?" Ron suggested. "Got any idea who you're going to try?" Harry didn't answer. He knew perfectly well whom he'd like to ask, but working up the nerve was something else. Cho was a year older than he was. She was very pretty. She was a very good Quidditch player, and she was also very popular. Ron seemed to know what was going on inside Harry's head. "Listen, you're not going to have any trouble. You're a champion. You've just beaten a Hungarian horntail. I bet they'll be queuing up to go with you." In tribute to their recently repaired friendship, Ron had kept the bitterness in his voice to a bare minimum. Moreover, to Harry's amazement, he turned out to be quite right. A curly-haired, third-year Hufflepuff girl, to whom Harry had never spoken in his life, asked him to go to the ball with her the very next day. Harry was so taken aback, he said no before he'd even stopped to consider the matter. The girl walked off looking rather hurt, and Harry had to endure Dean's, Seamus's and Ron's taunts about her all through History of Magic. The following day, two more girls asked him, a second year, and, to his horror, a fifth year, who looked as though she might knock him out if he refused. "She was quite good-looking," said Ron fairly, after he had stopped laughing. "She was a foot taller than me," said Harry, still unnerved. "Imagine what I'd look like trying to dance with her." Hermione's words about Crumb kept coming back to him. "They only like him because he's famous." Harry doubted very much if any of the girls who had asked to be his partner so far would have wanted to go to the ball with him if he hadn't been school champion. Then he wondered if this would bother him if Cho asked him. On the whole, Harry had to admit that even with the embarrassing prospect of opening the ball before him, life had definitely improved since he had got through the first task. He wasn't attracting nearly as much unpleasantness in the corridors any more, which he suspected had a lot to do with Cedric. He had an idea Cedric might have told the Hufflepuffs to leave Harry alone, in gratitude for Harry's tip-off about the dragons. There seemed to be fewer Support Cedric Diggory badges around, too. Draco Malfoy, of course, was still quoting Rita Skeeter's article at him at every possible opportunity, but he was getting fewer and fewer laughs out of it. And just to heighten Harry's feeling of well-being, no story about Hagrid had appeared in the Daily Prophet.
"She didn't seem very interested in magical creatures, to tell you the truth,"
Hagrid said, when Harry, Ron and Hermione asked him how his interview with Rita Skeeter had gone during the last Care of Magical Creatures lesson of term. To their very great relief, Hagrid had given up on direct contact with the Scroots now, and they were merely sheltering behind his cabin today, sitting at a trestle table and preparing a fresh selection of food with which to tempt the Scroots.
"She just wanted me to talk about you, Harry," Hagrid continued in a low voice. "Well, I told her we'd been friends since I went to fetch you from the Dursleys. Never had to tell him off in 4 years, she said. Never played you up in lessons, has he? I told her no, and she didn't seem happy at all. You'd think she wanted me to say you were horrible, Harry."
"Course she did," said Harry, throwing lumps of dragon liver into a large metal bowl and picking up his knife to cut some more. "She can't keep writing about what a tragic little hero I am. It'll get boring." "She wants a new angle, Hagrid," said Ron wisely as he shelled salamander eggs. "You were supposed to say Harry's a mad delinquent."
"But he's not," said Hagrid, looking genuinely shocked.
"She should have interviewed Snape," said Harry grimly. He'd give her the goods on me any day. Potter has been crossing lines ever since he first arrived at this school.
Said that, did he?
Said Hagrid, while Ron and Hermione laughed.
Well, you might have bent a few rules, Harry, but you're all right, really, aren't you?
Cheers, Hagrid, said Harry, grinning. You coming to this ball thing on Christmas Day, Hagrid? Said Ron.
Thought I might look in on it, yeah,
said Hagrid, gruffly.
Should be a good do, I reckon. You'll be opening the dancing, won't you, Harry? Who are you taking?
No one yet, said Harry, feeling himself going red again. Hagrid didn't pursue the subject. The last week of term became increasingly boisterous as it progressed. Rumours about the Yule Ball were flying everywhere, though Harry didn't believe half of them. For instance, that Dumbledore had bought 800 barrels of mulled mead from Madame Rosmerta. It seemed to be fact, however, that he had booked the Weird Sisters. Exactly who or what the Weird Sisters were, Harry didn't know, never having had access to a wizard's wireless, but he deduced from the wild excitement of those who had grown up listening to the WWN, Wizarding Wireless Network, that they were a very famous musical group. Some of the teachers, like little Professor Flitwick, gave up trying to teach them much when their minds were so clearly elsewhere. He allowed them to play games in his lesson on Wednesday, and spent most of it talking to Harry about the perfect summoning charm he had used during the first task of the Triwizard Tournament. Other teachers were not so generous. Nothing would ever deflect Professor Binns, for example, from ploughing on through his notes on goblin rebellions. As Binns hadn't let his own death stand in the way of continuing to teach, they supposed a small thing like Christmas wasn't going to put him off. It was amazing how he could make even bloody and vicious goblin riots sound as boring as Percy's cauldron bottom report. Professors McGonagall and Moody kept them working until the very last second of their classes, too. And Snape, of course, would no sooner let them play games in class than adopt Harry. Staring nastily around at them all, he informed them that he would be testing them on poison antidotes during the last lesson of the term.
"Evil he is," Ron said bitterly that night in the Gryffindor common room. "Springing a test on us on the last day. Ruining the last bit of term with a whole load of revision."
"You're not exactly straining yourself, though, are you?" said Hermione, looking at him over the top of her potions notes. Ron was busy building a card castle out of his exploding snap pack, a much more interesting pastime than with Muggle cards, because of the chance that the whole thing would blow up at any second. "It's Christmas, Hermione," said Harry lazily. He was rereading Flying with the Cannons for the 10th time in an armchair near the fire. Hermione looked severely over at him, too.
"I'd have thought you'd be doing something constructive, Harry, even if you don't want to learn your antidotes."
"Like what?" Harry said, as he watched Joey Jenkins of the Cannons belt a bludger towards a Ballycastle bat's chaser.
"That egg!" Hermione hissed.
"Come on, Hermione, I've got till February the 24th, Harry said. He had put the golden egg upstairs in his trunk and hadn't opened it since the celebration party after the first task. There were still 2.5 months to go until he needed to know what all the screechy wailing meant, after all.
"But it might take weeks to work it out," said Hermione. "You're going to look a real idiot if everyone else knows what the next task is and you don't."
"Leave him alone, Hermione. He's earned a bit of a break," said Ron, and he placed the last 2 cards on top of the castle, and the whole lot blew up, singeing his eyebrows.
"Nice look, Ron. Go well with your dress robes, that will."
It was Fred and George. They sat down at the table with Harry, Ron and Hermione, as Ron felt how much damage had been done.
"Ron, can we borrow Pigwidgeon?" George asked.
"No, he's off delivering a letter," said Ron.
"Why?"
"Because George wants to invite him to the ball," said Fred sarcastically.
"Because we want to send a letter, you stupid great Pratt," said George.
"Who do you two keep writing to, eh?" said Ron.
"Nose out, Ron, or I'll burn that for you too," said Fred, waving his wand threateningly.
"So, you lot got dates for the ball yet?"
"Nope," said Ron.
"Well, you better hurry up, mate, or all the good ones will be gone," said Fred.
"Who are you going with, then?" said Ron.
"Angelina," said Fred promptly, without a trace of embarrassment.
"What?" said Ron, taken aback. "You've already asked her."
"Good point," said Fred.
He turned his head and called across the common room. "Oi, Angelina!" Angelina, who had been chatting to Alicia Spinett near the fire, looked over at him. "What?" she called back. "Want to come to the ball with me?" Angelina gave Fred an appraising sort of look. "All right, then," she said, and she turned back to Alicia and carried on chatting, with a bit of a grin on her face. "There you go," said Fred to Harry and Ron. "Piece of cake." He got to his feet, yawning, and said, "We'd better use a school owl then, George. Come on." They left. Ron stopped feeling his eyebrows and looked across the smouldering wreck of his card castle at Harry. "We should get a move on, you know. Ask someone. He's right. We don't want to end up with a pair of trolls." Hermione let out a splutter of indignation.
"A pair of what, excuse me?"
"Well, you know," said Ron, shrugging, "I'd rather go alone than with Eloise Midgin, say."
"Her acne's loads better lately, and she's really nice."
"Her nose is off-centre," said Ron.
"Oh, I see," Hermione said, bristling. "So, basically, you're going to take the best-looking girl who'll have you, even if she's completely horrible."
Yeah, that sounds about right," said Ron.
"I'm going to bed,"
Hermione snapped, and she swept off towards the girls' staircase without another word. The Hogwarts staff, demonstrating a continued desire to impress the visitors from Beauxbatons and Durmstrang, seemed determined to show the castle at its best this Christmas. When the decorations went up, Harry noticed that they were the most stunning he had yet seen inside the school. Everlasting icicles had been attached to the banisters of the marble staircase. The usual 12 Christmas trees in the great hall were bedecked with everything from luminous holly berries to real, hooting golden owls, and the suits of armour had all been bewitched to sing carols whenever anyone passed them. It was quite something to hear "O Come All Ye Faithful" sung by an empty helmet that only knew half the words. Several times Filch, the caretaker, had to extract Peeves from inside the armour where he had taken to hiding, filling in the gaps in the songs with lyrics of his own invention, all of which were very rude. And still Harry hadn't asked Cho to the ball. He and Ron were getting very nervous now, though, as Harry pointed out, Ron would look much less stupid than he would without a partner. Harry was supposed to be starting the dancing with the other champions. "I suppose there's always Moaning Myrtle," he said gloomily, referring to the ghost who haunted the girls' toilets on the second floor. "Harry, we've just got to grit our teeth and do it," said Ron on Friday morning, in a tone that suggested they were planning the storming of an impregnable fortress. "When we get back to the common room tonight, we'll both have partners. Agreed?" Okay," said Harry. But every time he glimpsed Cho that day, during break and then lunchtime, and once on the way to History of Magic, she was surrounded by friends. Didn't she ever go anywhere alone? Could he perhaps ambush her as she was going into a bathroom? But no, she even seemed to go there with an escort of 4 or 5 girls. Yet if he didn't do it soon, she was bound to have been asked by somebody else. He found it hard to concentrate in Snape's antidote test, and consequently forgot to add the key ingredient, a bezoar, meaning that he received bottom marks. He didn't care, though. He was too busy screwing up his courage for what he was about to do. When the bell rang, he grabbed his bag and hurried to the dungeon door. "I'll meet you at dinner," he said to Ron and Hermione, and he dashed off upstairs. He'd just have to ask Cho for a private word, that was all. He hurried off through the packed corridors looking for her, and, rather sooner than he had expected, he found her emerging from a Defence Against the Dark Arts lesson. "Cho, could I have a word with you?" "Giggling should be made illegal," Harry thought furiously, as all the girls around Cho started doing it. She didn't, though. She said, "Okay," and followed him out of earshot of her classmates. Harry turned to look at her, and his stomach gave a weird lurch, as though he had missed a step going downstairs. He said. He couldn't ask her. He couldn't. But he had to. Cho stood there, looking puzzled, watching him. The words came out before Harry had quite got his tongue around them. "Want to go ball with me?" "Sorry?" said Cho. "Do you want to go to the ball with me?" said Harry,
Why did he have to go red now? Why?
Oh, said Cho, and she went red too.
Oh, Harry, I'm really sorry.
And she looked it too.
I've already said I'll go with someone else.
Oh, said Harry. It was odd. A moment before, his insides had been writhing like snakes. But suddenly he didn't seem to have any insides at all.
Oh, okay, he said. No problem. I'm really sorry, she said again.
That's okay, said Harry. They stood there looking at each other, and then Cho said,
Well,
yeah, said Harry.
Well, bye,
said Cho, still very red. She walked away. Harry called after her, before he could stop himself.
Who are you going with?
Oh, Cedric, she said. Cedric Diggory.
Oh, right, said Harry.
His insides had come back again. It felt as though they had been filled with lead in their absence. Completely forgetting about dinner, he walked slowly back up to Gryffindor Tower, Cho's voice echoing in his ears with every step he took.
Cedric, Cedric Diggory.
He had been starting to quite like Cedric, prepared to overlook the fact that he had once beaten him at Quidditch and was handsome and popular and nearly everyone's favourite champion. Now he suddenly realised that Cedric was, in fact, a useless, pretty boy who didn't have enough brains to fill an egg cup. "Fairy lights," he said dully to the fat lady. The password had been changed the previous day.
"Yes, indeed, dear,"
she trilled, straightening her new tinsel hairband as she swung forwards to admit him. Entering the common room, Harry looked around, and to his surprise he saw Ron sitting ashen-faced in a distant corner. Ginny was sitting with him, talking to him in what seemed to be a low, soothing voice.
"What's up, Ron?" said Harry, joining them.
Ron looked up at Harry, a sort of blind horror in his face.
"Why did I do it?" he said wildly. "I don't know what made me do it!"
"What?" said Harry.
"He, just asked Fleur Delacour to go to the ball with him," said Ginny.
She looked as though she was fighting back a smile, but she kept patting Ron's arm sympathetically.
"You what?" said Harry. "I don't know what made me do it,"
Ron gasped again.
"What was I playing at? There were people all around. I've gone mad. Everyone watching. I was just walking past her in the entrance hall. She was standing there talking to Diggory, and it sort of came over me, and I asked her."
Ron moaned and put his face in his hands. He kept talking, though the words were barely distinguishable.
"She looked at me like I was a sea slug or something, didn't even answer, and then, I don't know, I just sort of came to my senses and ran for it."
"She's part Vila," said Harry. "You were right, her grandmother was one. It wasn't your fault. I bet you just walked past when she was turning on the old charm for Diggory and got a blast of it. But she was wasting her time. He's going with Cho Chang." Ron looked up. "I asked her to go with me just now," Harry said dully, "and she told me." Ginny had suddenly stopped smiling.
"This is mad," said Ron. "We're the only ones left who haven't got anyone. Well, except Neville. Hey, guess who he asked? Hermione."
"What?" said Harry, completely distracted by this startling news.
"Yeah, I know,"
said Ron, some of the colour coming back into his face as he started to laugh.
"He told me after potions. Said she's always been really nice, helping him out with work and stuff, but she told him she was already going with someone."
"As if. She just didn't want to go with Neville. I mean, who would?"
"Don't," said Ginny, annoyed. "Don't laugh."
Just then, Hermione climbed in through the portrait hole.
"Why weren't you two at dinner?"
she said, coming over to join them.
"Because—oh, shut up laughing, you two! Because they've both just been turned down by girls they asked to the ball,"
said Ginny. That shut Harry and Ron up.
"Thanks a bunch, Ginny," said Ron sourly.
"All the good-looking ones taken, Ron," said Hermione loftily. "Eloise Midgin's starting to look quite pretty now, is she? Well, I'm sure you'll find someone somewhere who'll have you."
But Ron was staring at Hermione as though suddenly seeing her in a whole new light.
"Hermione, Neville's right. You are a girl."
"Oh, well spotted," she said acidly. "Well, you can come with one of us."
"No, I can't," snapped Hermione.
"Oh, come on," he said impatiently. "We need partners. We're going to look really stupid if we haven't got any. Everyone else has."
"I can't come with you," said Hermione, now blushing, "because I'm already going with someone."
"No, you're not," said Ron. "You just said that to get rid of Neville."
"Oh, did I?" said Hermione, and her eyes flashed dangerously. "Just because it's taken you 3 years to notice, Ron, doesn't mean no one else has spotted I'm a girl."
Ron stared at her. Then he grinned again.
"Okay, okay, we know you're a girl," he said. "That do? Will you come now?"
"I've already told you," Hermione said very angrily. "I'm going with someone else." And she stormed off towards the girls' dormitories again.
"She's lying," said Ron flatly, watching her go.
"She's not," said Ginny quietly.
"Who is it, then?" said Ron sharply.
"I'm not telling you. It's her business," said Ginny.
"Right," said Ron, who looked extremely put out. "This is getting stupid. Ginny, you can go with Harry, and I'll just..."
"I can't," said Ginny, and she went scarlet too. "I'm going with Neville. He asked me when Hermione said no, and I thought, well, I'm not going to be able to go otherwise. I'm not in fourth year."
She looked extremely miserable.
"I think I'll go and have dinner," she said, and she got up and walked off to the portrait hole, her head bowed.
Ron goggled at Harry.
"What's got into them?" he demanded.
But Harry had just seen Parvati and Lavender come in through the portrait hole. The time had come for drastic action.
"Wait here," he said to Ron, and he stood up, walked straight up to Parvati, and said, "Parvati, will you go to the ball with me?"
Parvati went into a fit of giggles.
Harry waited for them to subside, his fingers crossed in the pocket of his robes.
"Yes, all right then," she said, finally, blushing furiously.
"Thanks," said Harry in relief. "Lavender, will you go with Ron?"
"She's going with Seamus," said Parvati, and the pair of them giggled harder than ever.
Harry sighed. "Can't you think of anyone who'd go with Ron?" he said, lowering his voice so that Ron wouldn't hear.
"What about Hermione Granger?" said Parvati.
"She's going with someone else."
Parvati looked astonished.
"Ooh, who?" she said keenly.
Harry shrugged.
"No idea," he said.
"So what about Ron?"
"Well," said Parvati slowly, "I suppose my sister might. Padma, you know, in Ravenclaw. I'll ask her if you like."
"Yeah, that would be great," said Harry. "Let me know, will you?"
And he went back over to Ron, feeling that this ball was a lot more trouble than it was worth, and hoping very much that Padma Patil's nose was dead centre.